our society are important. I think there's a number of reasons probably why cities moved away from this form that was so popular back in the early 1900s. But I suspect, though I don't know, that one of those reasons had to do with the fact that there was little checks and balances, other than at election time. I think that the checks and balances between the legislative and executive function will be stronger, and that it will allow the passions, and you've heard some of the passion this afternoon from our city council members, to develop policy and to oversee the implementation, because one of their council's jobs is the oversight of the implementation of public policy. They will be able to see whether that's being done or not. The example that Commissioner Leonard gave of the woman calling is a good example, and I think these examples can be played either way. But you would have to ask yourself, if that had not been Commissioner Leonard, but somebody else, would they have reacted the same? And if you had to go back and trace back to who is responsible for cutting this senior citizen's water off, then I think that would be very easy to do. I do believe in the public's eye that a lot of folks think that the mayor has responsibility for the city. But, you know, they don't. I don't. And I think it is important to distinguish between the functions of the mayor and the city council. I looked at all of the elections, or most of the elections, there's a couple I could not find, about when this should go to the voters. And interestingly, of the seven that I found that have to do with the city charter, six of them occurred in May or June. And so it seems to be a fairly popular time. And I'll tell you the reason why I think it's important that we do this in this May, is that I believe that voter attention tends to drift off, and I want people to be engaged in the discussions about this. And the way we do it is by putting a timeline in there that is certain, and that by this date, the voters will make a decision. I also think it's important that for the next mayoral election and council election, that people have adequate notice of what they will be running for. And I believe that by having this go to the voters, and if it's approved, then every person thinking about the mayor's job or a city council job has a very clear set of what they will be required to do, and then leave it up to them as to how they're going to do it. But on May 15th, the voters of this city will make a decision, and I can live with that decision, because I know that between now and the next 3 months, that they're going to be getting a lot of opportunities to learn from this and to develop their own positions about whether this is a good idea or not. And I'm looking forward to that discussion. I'm looking forward to working with this council, going out and talking with the community, and ultimately our citizens making that decision. And I think it was the right thing for this council to do today, to bring this package of charter reform proposals before the voters and let them decide as to the value of these particular proposals. I want to thank the Charter Review Commission. You are probably very pleased to hear that this is your last day of existence and that you won't have to come here to council, at least for a long time, and talk with us. But you folks have just done a tremendous service. And the folks who came up to testify that had been on the Charter Commission, every one of them to a person, talked about the ethical behavior, the fact that everybody on that Charter Review Commission's one goal was to do what was best for our city. And I thank them for that, and I support their recommendations, and we're going to go out and have a great discussion in our community about this. So I want to thank all the commissioners for your involvement, your words, and I look forward to us making our city a better place for everyone. I vote aye. I do believe there's an arrest of the agenda, though. And we do have, pardon?
PDC.
Oh, that's right, PDC, my God.
It's just a little housekeeping measure there, Mayor.
Good point.
We're only three quarters away.
I guess I was getting ready to jump the gun. Okay. Yes, so please read item 111.
Refer amendments to the City of Portland Charter, Chapter 15, Portland Development Commission, to the May 15, 2007 special election ballot to provide for additional city council oversight.
Thank you, Mayor Katz.
Thank you.
Vice Senior.
There has been a proposal which is in the hands of the council in terms of how to move this forward. Do we have people signed up to testify on this matter?
We have two people signed up.
Are there questions that need to be answered by the council members before we move to this?
No. I don't know if you want me to describe it or not.
Yeah, go ahead.
Probably have an audience somewhere. Maybe not still. I'll attempt to be brief. I just always like to explain what I'm proposing and the council's proposing. This charter amendment, if passed by the voters, would make the city council the budget committee that oversees PDC. And that's a very specific term that I've worked with the mayor and our legislative council to figure out. And essentially what it would mean, very simply, is that the Portland Development Commission would submit its budget annually to the city council for review and adoption. That would be a mandatory requirement. At this point, and I will keep the explanation side very short, and there'll be plenty of time to talk about this. The Development Commission, I believe, should stay quasi-independent. It makes sense for them to pick developers, strategies, but it is the only body in the state of any size run primarily by property tax, in this case $250 million, that has no, and the mayor just gave, I think, though we don't agree on that measure at eloquence, discussion of checks and balances, and at this point, the Development Commission has no budget review of any kind required by anybody. It's simply an appointed body that spends $250 million. Under this proposal, it would come to the council for an annual adoption. The council would then adopt the budget and send it back, which is very different from the way we have bureaus that are under our direct control. And there has been proposals in the past. Commissioner Leonard has proposed having the PDC be a bureau of the city. This would not do that. The Development Commission, which would continue to be nominated by the mayor and confirmed by the council, would get the budget back, they would finally adopt it, and they would have authority to move the council's budget within 10% in each fund. And so essentially they would remain the implementing agency. I actually think, and I'll say this relatively quickly, that when you look at all the good things PDC has done and all the debates that have happened in this community, that both sides of this equation need this kind of change. Because I would say, I'm speaking about myself, not about others, the council itself doesn't own PDC's budget. And so what happens is, because we're not tied into that budget, we often tend to get too into the details, to come after projects. The Development Commission budget is not as well tied in the past to the Planning Commission, other places it could be. By having an annual adoption process, we would be able to run their budget through our public processes, which are much better attended than the Development Commission's, show it to the public, adopt it, align it with other things that are happening at the council level. And then I think that the Development Commission and the Executive Director would be in a much stronger position between the July 1 to July 1 fiscal year to say to the council, you've adopted this budget, so do not come after us and try and change the projects mid-year, which happens all the time and we're all guilty of. So I think this is a better structure and look forward to getting this debate out there in the community, and just wanted to make sure we explained it a little bit so that people knew what it was. Thank you, Mayor.
And it really is important, because for PDC to know, as well as the larger community, is that it really clearly defines the role and relationship between PDC and the City of Portland. And us setting policy and approving the budget for the implementation, but PDC having the authority to solely implement that budget, I think it will give them that flexibility. And I'm pleased that we came to this agreement, and that this measure will go to, with the rest of the package, out to the voters for approval. And I will be supporting this out in the community, as I'm sure others on the council will as well. So with that, go ahead and call the.
We have Garland Norman and Amanda Fritz.
Anybody who's left here now is officially a wonk.
So what was the other name?
Didn't we know that before?
Yeah.
Garland Norman.
Garland Norman. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm Amanda Fritz, speaking only for myself. It is very sad for people who care about public participation in Portland that after 6 hours, the only change to the Charter Review Commission's recommendations has been to add a requirement for a public hearing before the next iteration of charter changes is rushed to voters. I am disappointed that the decisions had obviously already been made. So I will use my time first to wish Commissioner Adams a speedy recovery, and second, to talk to the people of Portland. If you're watching this on cable, you have seen the power of the mayor under the current form of government. Despite the flaws highlighted by citizen testimony, two commissioners have supported the mayor in every vote taken today. We are now discussing the Portland Development Commission, which for many people in Portland over the years has illustrated some of the problems that can happen when people who are not elected have authority over taxpayers' money, as will be the case if the proposal for the chief administrative officer passes. Despite what the Portland Business Alliance and the Oregonian will be selling to voters over the next 3 months, there is no compelling reason to approve any of the charter changes already sent to the ballot today. There is no urgency other than that created by people wanting more power for a single person rather than an elected group of five. The only measure I will support in May is this one to make this Portland City Council the budget committee for the Portland Development Commission. What we should do is pass that one, then see what else needs to be done to reform the Portland Development Commission and to keep Portland, Portland. Other than that, I urge citizens who care about public process and access of citizens to elected officials with the power to address their concerns to vote no on all of the other ballot measures.
Is that all the folks signed up? Okay. Any further discussion? Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
This is a very important change, and I think it, for those who might think I'm being inconsistent, let me explain why I believe I'm being entirely consistent. I voted against the other proposals because I think it will decrease accountability of elected officials. I'm voting for this provision because it actually adds accountability to the council for the behavior of the Portland Development Commission. I think it's no surprise to anybody, this is a minimum change that I would be willing to make. And it's something that has been discussed in the community a lot in the last 2 years. So I appreciate being able to support this so I'm not just a wet blanket on everything coming before us today. And I, too, will join the mayor in vigorously, and Amanda Fritz and others, and vigorously campaigning to pass this really needed change in how Portland's economic development future is crafted. Aye.
Seltzman?
Well, this seems like a good measure, and I guess I just want to remind everybody, since it's been 6 hours, we're voting here today to take the body of work a group of citizens spent 14 months on and let another debate occur with the broader public. We're not voting here today to express our positions on these issues, although that's clearly evident. People do have positions on these issues. The fundamental test is here, do these questions deserve the input of voters? And that's what we're doing here. And that's why I, along with everybody, is going to vote to send this one to the ballot. Even though we've had mixed accounts, mixed votes on the others, it's fundamental test is, should the public get in on this debate? I believe they should. Aye.
Sten.
I think I've said enough. Aye.
Potter.
So have I. Aye. We read item 124.
Urge Congress to remedy the inequality in the law that gives the Northwest the highest levels of benzene in the country.
Commissioner Leonard.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Most of our gasoline comes from Alaska, where oil is naturally rich in benzene, with as much as 10 times more benzene in the oil than from other parts of the world. Benzene is known to cause cancer, such as leukemia, and it causes immune system disorders and other life-threatening health problems. Gasoline in the Northwest contains about twice as much benzene as the national average, and much of it ends up in the air along major highways and urban centers. Some Portland residents, especially in and around downtown where we are right now, breathe more than 40 times the concentrations of benzene that is considered safe over the long term, according to an analysis done by the Department of Environmental Quality. Big oil companies are unconscionably leaning on the Bush administration currently to ease rules requiring limits on benzene for Northwest refineries. Instead of requiring refineries to buy equipment to reduce benzene levels in their products, a new proposed EPA rule would allow big oil to buy or trade credits from other refineries that already produce fuel with lower benzene contents. Senator Ron Wyden has accurately described this practice as a regulatory shell game. The EPA should quit listening to the big oil companies and should enact uniform national limits on benzene and fuel that are applied equally to every region in the United States, including Oregon. Thank you.
No one signed up.
Okay, this is a resolution. Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Stinn?
Aye.
Potter?
I want to thank Commissioner Leonard for doing this.
Thank you.
This is really important. If you look at the benzene cancer rates in the, along our freeway system in Portland, it's much higher than the national average, and I think that is just abominable. So thank you for bringing it to attention. And when I'm back in D.C. next week, I'm going to be taking this information back to our legislature.
Excellent.
Back
there.
So
thank
I
you.
Vote aye. Please read item 125.
Authorize a labor agreement with Laborers Local 483 for terms and conditions of employment of represented employees in the Recreation Bargaining Unit.
Can we read 25 and 125 and 126?
Yes.
Together. Thanks.
Authorize a labor agreement with the City of Portland, Portland Professional Employees Association for terms and conditions of employment in represented employees in the bargaining unit.
Staff. Good afternoon, Mayor and Council. It's been a long day, so I'm going to try to make this very quick. Today, I want to present items 25 and 26 regarding ratification between the City of Portland and the REC Employees Union, which is represented by Local 483 and the City of Portland Professionals Employee Association. And I will refer to them as Recreation and COPIA from this point forward. The tentative agreement with these bargaining units were obtained through a combination of pre-negotiation dialogue and good faith bargaining. The terms of the agreement are that these are both three-year agreements that will begin July 1st, 2007 and expire June 30th of 2010. The current agreements expire this June of 2007. It calls for a CPI increase on wages effective July 1st of 2007. 2008 and 2009 with a floor of 2% and a ceiling of 5%. Concerning health care and benefits, the city shall contribute 95% of the combined total of medical, visual, and dental rates as adopted by council. An employee should contribute 5%. The level of benefits shall be retained in effect for the duration of these agreements. These are the same conditions in which we have offered other bargaining units to date. The unions have also, Recreation and COPIA has also agreed to continue to work with the city, with the Bureau, and with the Council on wellness, health, and disease management strategies. They have signed off on our wellness strategy. They've agreed to continue to work with the rest of the unions, the rest of labor and council in representing city employees by meeting annually with the council to discuss the programs and review progress to date and to continue to work in a labor management collaborative effort to have bureaus identify work processes, systems, and other requirements that could result in savings and or efficiencies that can help offset cost. It's important for the council to know that each of these unions in signing off on these agreements have agreed to those things. We've worked collaboratively to achieve these agreements, and we look forward to a long-term approach aimed at resolving our health care cost containment. I recommend the council ratify these agreements. They've already been ratified by both Recreation and by COPIA. In doing so, the city will have agreements with all of its bargaining units with the exception of PFFA. We are scheduled to meet with PFFA to establish ground rules on both March 7th and 22nd, and we will begin formal bargaining with them on April 4th.
Questions? Good job, folks. Was anybody signed up to testify on this matter?
Sorry, no one signed up.
Okay. These are both emergency votes. Please call the vote.
Adams?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye.
Mayor, I was going to ask, is there any reason that Commissioner Adams has to stay on the line?
No.
There's four of us here, and I actually, for humane reasons, would like to see him hang up.
He feels guilty, Sam. That's his way of saying that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks
Sam.
For hanging in.
Just is bothering
you. I feel pretty good. Stay on
the line. It is just a little bit.
Okay, so do we need to vote on each one separately? Okay, so that was a vote for 125. And then 126, please call a vote.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. Item 127 is being held over until next week.
I should read the title. Adopt findings and authorize an exemption to the competitive bidding process to the Bureau of Purchases pursuant to ORS 279C and City Code 5.34 and provide payment for construction of the Gabriel Park Skate Park project.
Please read item 128.
128, sorry. Grant a franchise to PacifiCorp for a period of 20 years.
Second reading, vote only. Please call the vote.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
I just want to thank the staff at both PacifiCorp and the Office of Cable and Franchise Management and many other people in the city, city attorney's office as well, who labored long and hard over this new 20-year franchise. Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye. We'll now proceed to our 2 p.m. I'd like to remind folks, prior to offering public testimony to the City Council, a lobbyist must declare which lobbying entity he or she is authorized to represent. Please read item 129.
Accept staff report and recommendation and order of council for Robert M. Boyle, Measure 37, claim.
Staff?
Sorry for the delay. Good afternoon. My name is Chris Dirth. I'm the city's Measure 37 program manager, and we have a very quick and easy claim for you this afternoon, brought by Robert Boyle and Jane Justina Boyle. The claim is located in the Southwest Hills neighborhood. On the map there, you can see. This is a zoning map of that neighborhood. You can see the Boyle property in pink in the center of the zone map there. It is in the R5 zone. That means one residence per 5,000 square feet. The Boyle property is 8,400 square feet. You can see that the neighborhood surrounding the Boyle property is mixed with larger properties like the Boyles and smaller, closer to 5,000 square feet. The Boyles are seeking an adjustment review to allow greater density on their property and a partition of their lot, which is currently prohibited under the current code. This is an aerial photo of the Boyle property. You can see in the center of the photo there in yellow, the Boyle home is on the northern end of the lot fronting High Street. The southern end of the lot, which they would like to partition into a second lot, fronts on Terrace Drive. To summarize a claim for you, it's brought by Robert Boyle and Jane Justina Boyle at 1826 Southwest High Street, submitted in November of last year. The compensation demanded is $129,915. The preferred resolution is either compensation or waiver of the regulations. These are the six criteria that we consider when analyzing a Measure 37 claim. You've seen them before, and I won't run through them for you. The two regulations challenged by the Boyles are those that you see there. They're challenging these regulations, which prohibit a request for an adjustment review to allow them to exceed the maximum permitted density on their property. These are indeed land use regulations under Measure 37, and they have been enforced simply because the Boyles are not allowed to apply for an adjustment review as they would have previously. We judge this to be adequate enforcement on the property. To analyze whether there has been restriction of use, we look back to when they purchased the property in October of 1991. They could have pursued a land division review and an adjustment review at that time in 91. In July of 2002, the city adopted a zoning code changes that eliminated that ability to request an adjustment review to exceed maximum allowed density. So therefore, at the time of purchase in 91, the Boyles had an avenue to request relief to the density standards on their property. That avenue has been closed, and the use of their property has, in our judgment, been restricted. And similarly, because they can't apply for an adjustment review to exceed maximum allowed density, it's more likely than not, in our analysis, that the value of the Boyles property has been reduced by at least $1 as required under the measure for a valid claim. So in summary and conclusion, the use of the subject property has been restricted and the value has likely been reduced. And therefore, our recommendation to you would be to approve the Boyles Measure 37 claim to allow them to request a density adjustment review. And I should point out that this doesn't prejudge what the outcome of that review might be. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you, Chris. Could the claimant please come forward? Good afternoon, folks. You have a total of 15 minutes, and you can use it as you see fit. When you speak, if you would please state your name for the record, we would appreciate it.
Your Honor, I'm Gary St. Louis. I'm attorney for Jane Justina Boyle and Robert Boyle, and with me here is Jane Justina Boyle. And we did not intend to testify today, but we would like to state that we concur with the staff recommendations. And as stated, this is no guarantee that this lot adjustment will occur. It's only giving us the opportunity to be heard, which we formerly had the right to and now no longer have.
Questions from the council?
Thank you, folks. Did you want to make a statement?
No.
Okay.
I appreciated your succinct argument.
You won my yes vote with that succinct argument.
Need a motion to adopt the staff report and order as the council's decision.
So moved.
Second.
Is there people here signed up to testify on this matter? Okay, thank you. Please call the vote.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Sten?
Aye.
Potter?
Aye.
Thank you, folks. 3 p.m. time certain. Please read item 130.
Appeal of Goose Hollow Foothills League against the hearing officer's decision to approve the application of Cynthia L. Hilliard for a zoning map amendment from R7 to R2 in compliance with the existing comprehensive plan map designation of low-density multi-dwelling residential and for adjustment reviews at 1970 Southwest Mill Street Terrace, LU06-109-528-ZC.
Would the city attorney please describe the process?
This is an evidentiary hearing today, which means you may submit new evidence to the council in support of your arguments. This evidence may be in any form, such as testimonies, letters, petitions, slides, photographs, maps, or drawings. Any photographs, drawings, maps, or other items you show to council during your testimony should be given to the council clerk at the end of your testimony to ensure it becomes part of the record. We will begin with a staff report by the Bureau of Development Services staff for approximately 10 minutes. Following the staff report, the City Council will hear from interested persons in the following order. The appellant will go first and have 10 minutes to present his or her case. Following the appellant, persons who support the appeal will go next. Each person will have 3 minutes to speak to council. The 3-minute time limit applies regardless of whether you're speaking for yourself or on behalf of a neighborhood association or business association. Principal opponent, usually, and in this case the applicant, will have 15 minutes to address council and rebut the appellant's presentation. After the principal opponent, the council will hear from persons who oppose the appeal. If there is no principal opponent, the council will move directly to testimony from persons who oppose the appeal. Again, each person will have 3 minutes each. Finally, the appellant will have 5 minutes to rebut the presentation of opponents of the appeal. Council may then close the hearing, deliberate, and take a vote on the appeal. If the vote is a tentative vote, the council will set a future date for the adoption of findings and a final vote on the appeal. If council takes a final vote today, that will conclude the matter before council. There are several guidelines for presenting testimony and participating in the hearing. The guidelines are established by the code and state law and are as follows. 1, testimony must be directed to approval criteria. Any testimony and evidence you present must be directed toward the applicable approval criteria for this land use review or other criteria in the city's comprehensive plan or zoning code that you believe apply to the decision. BDS staff will identify the applicable approval criteria as part of their staff report to the council. 2, issues must be raised with specificity. If you fail to raise an issue clearly enough to give the council and the parties an opportunity to respond to the issue, you will be precluded from appealing to the Land Use Board of Appeals based on that issue. 3, the applicant must identify constitutional challenges to conditions of approval. If the applicant fails to raise constitutional or other issues relating to proposed conditions of approval with enough specificity to allow counsel to respond, the applicant will be precluded from bringing an action for damages in circuit court to challenge the conditions of approval.
Thank you. Do any members of council wish to declare a conflict of interest? No council members have a conflict of interest to declare. Do any members of council have any ex parte contacts to declare or information gathered outside of the hearing to disclose? No council members have ex parte contacts to declare. Do any members of council have questions or other preliminary matters that need to be addressed before we begin the hearing? Staff, please come forward.
Thank you, Mayor Potter, Commissioners. I'm Kathleen Stokes, BDS staff for this case. It is a review of the appeal of the hearings officer's decision on a zoning map amendment and adjustments for the property at 1970 Southwest Mill Street Terrace. I will try to be as brief as possible since time is running late, but if I gloss over any of the text in this presentation and you have questions, please ask me to fill in the answers for you. As I said, it's a zoning map amendment, and the request is to change the zoning map from R7, the medium-density single-dwelling zone, to R2, which is a low-density multi-dwelling zone. And this is in compliance with the existing comprehensive plan map designation for the site. The R2 zone allows one unit for every 2,000 square feet of site area, and because this site has 4,081 square feet, there would be a maximum of two residential units that would be allowed under this zone. The existing zoning on the site, the R7, would allow one primary residential unit and also one accessory dwelling unit. So the difference here, you have two units, the difference is that the R2 zone would allow the second dwelling unit to be larger in size than the second unit that could be allowed under the R7 designation. The approval criteria for a zoning map amendment that is in compliance with the comprehensive plan designation is basically limited to whether the city services are adequate to support the density that's allowed under the requested zone. City service agencies in this case found that with some upgrades to the site that include installation of fire sprinklers, there would be no increase in the burden on city services. A development plan was originally proposed, and this plan included renovations to the existing house on the site and also the construction of a second dwelling unit on the lower part of the site, which would be over the street front garage and carport areas. Because the site has a severe slope, there was a proposal to include an elevator that would allow access to upper stories of the existing house. Several adjustments were requested to allow exceptions to development standards for the R2 zone. Those included reduced garage entrance setbacks, an increase in the allowed amount of building coverage, an increase in the allowed height, and reduced building setbacks from the front or east and south and north side property lines. The Goose Hollow Neighborhood Association appealed the hearings officer's decision of approval, noting that the approval criteria for the requested zoning map amendment were met, but that the neighborhood did not agree that all of the approval criteria were met for the requested adjustments. Because the applicant signed a waiver to a right to a final local decision within 120 days, this is what is termed a de novo hearing. This allows the applicant to make changes to the proposal and the development plans in order to address concerns that are raised in an appeal, and that has occurred. Some parts of the existing development that were constructed by the previous owner without review for building permit and not without going through the building permit review process will be removed. Plans for the remaining development that was legally constructed or for the parts that are proposed to be legalized as well as the new improvements are considered part of this review. Because these reviews have been requested by the applicant in order to legalize those portions of the existing development that were built illegally, the illegal development is not part of this consideration. Due to the revised plans that the applicant's now proposing, some of the adjustments that were originally requested are no longer needed, and some of them have been amended because the request has been reduced. And so we'll talk about how that sits now, the status currently of the requested adjustments. The request to reduce minimum garage entrance setback for the carport and garage, the garage entrance setback was previously approved under a variance, but it was incorporated into this adjustment along with the carport. That one is still being requested. The request to increase maximum building coverage from 50% to 67.4% of the site area has been amended. The elevator was eliminated from the proposal, and some other small changes have reduced the building coverage somewhat. So now the applicant is asking for 62.7% of the site. The request to increase the maximum height of the overall development from 40 feet to 54 feet 11 inches was originally requested because the proposal called for the two portions of the development, the low part on the lower half of the site, which would be the second unit, to be attached to the existing house on the upper part of the site. And this meant that the way we measured height was as if it was all one structure because it was attached. So it would be from the grade level at the street at the front of the lot to the midpoint of the highest roof plane on the house. These structures are no longer proposed to be attached. So now the buildings are measured separately, and each of them meets the code requirements in R2 for the height limits. So therefore, this adjustment is no longer being requested. The final adjustment was, actually, there were three in one, the way it was written up, but those were for three different setbacks. Setbacks were originally reduced under variances for the existing development on the site. And the request for the adjustments were because the structure was going up above the garage and carport, so there was new building wall within the setback, and also because we measure setbacks differently in the R2 zone than we do in the R7 zone. The applicant has amended the proposal by moving the living area over the garage back from the south property line so that that portion of the structure would meet the R2 setback requirement. The requests for setbacks adjustments for the front and the north property lines are still being requested. For the record, the approval criteria for these reviews, for the zoning map amendments, it's section 33.855.050. I was asked to include the text of these of the approval criteria for the zoning map amendments and adjustments in this presentation. To save time, I'm not going to read all of that. The City Council has a printout and is able to refer to the approval criteria text if they wish. Just briefly, criterion A, 33.855.050A, simply asks that if there's more than one zone that agrees with the comprehensive plan map designation, is this the appropriate one? In this case, there's only one zoning designation that agrees with the comprehensive plan designation. Therefore, this criterion does not actually apply in this case. As I said before, the main and only, really, approval criteria for the zoning map amendment is whether there are adequate public services. And the text for this criterion is shown in this slide. Adjustments have several approval criteria, some of which apply in this case and some of which don't. One of the meatiest of these is always whether the adjustment that is being requested will equally or better meet the purpose of the regulation that's to be modified. In this residential zone, we also look at whether approval of the adjustments would significantly detract from livability or appearance of the residential area. We also look at whether there are cumulative impacts that would be in opposition to the purpose of the zone from more than one adjustment. We also look at whether the impacts, criterion E, whether the impacts resulting from the adjustment are mitigated to the extent practical. Since there are no city-designated scenic resources or historic resources on this property, and it is not in an environmental zone, criteria D and F do not apply in this case. This slide shows the existing zoning on the site, and you see the yellow arrow pointing to the property, and if you see the little dotted line around the properties that front onto Mill Street Terrace, that is showing the area that has the comprehensive plan designation, which is shown in parentheses after the R7. Anything outside of that dotted line is not part of that comprehensive plan designation, but has zoning and comprehensive plan designation, which are in agreement with each other, so there's no alternate designation shown in parentheses. This is showing what's proposed, which is simply that this property would come into compliance with the comprehensive plan designation and would, if approved, be zoned R2 in the future.
How much more do you have?
I have.
How much will you need?
I'll try to hurry through it in a couple minutes.
Okay.
Next couple slides are showing the proposed site plan and building elevations. I'm going to scan through those quickly. You'll see the lower structure would be the second unit. I have a number of slides showing the existing conditions, including the illegally built additions, such as the metal decks that you see on the right-hand side of the picture.
So the top floor was the illegal part where the glass is?
Those are all illegal additions onto the house, which was the house itself was legally built, and it's at the distance at the back of the picture. There are some other slides that show the house without portions of the house that don't have these illegal additions on them. This is the carport on the right and garage on the left. There's a portion of the house and the stairway going up to the upper part of the property. It's a 37% slope. See, looking down over the roof of the carport and the house across the street to the freeway below. There's a alleyway that passes on the west side with simply a pedestrian walkway. And the houses along that are all built to the edge of the property. This is the next door neighbor here. And this is the applicant's property showing their deck. And that alleyway connects to Vista above. And this is probably the best picture I was able to get, actually, of the original house. The slope made it difficult to get very good perspective. Going back here, again, showing the garage entrance setback requirements and, again, showing some of the illegal development here that would be removed, including the materials hoist that's on the left side of this picture. This shows the existing structure above the garage, which was built illegally and is being or has been destroyed, and would the new structure above the garage would be moved back further to meet the south side setback, which is shown there. And then it's just this is where this property joins the property to the south, and showing what's typical on some of these steep hillsides in this area. I'm not going to go back over this slide because I've pretty much covered all of the zoning map amendment summary in my earlier remarks. Excuse me. And I also talked about how the plans have been adjusted so that they're meeting more of the R2 development standards, and talked about what is still being asked for. So I don't think there's any point in going over this part in detail either. I am hoping that council finds that the revised plans do attempt to address the issues raised by the neighborhood, and that the approval criteria can be found to be met. And I would ask that City Council approve the revised proposal with a return to council for adoption of staff's revised findings on this issue in 28 to 35 days. It'll take about that long to revise them and get a review with city attorney. I just want to mention finally that the hearings officer's decision approving the zoning map amendment and adjustments strictly limited the approval to the proposal at the time that it was presented to him, and so it would not encompass these revisions that have been made to address the neighborhood's concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Could the appellant please come forward? You're normally allowed 10 minutes, but because the staff went over almost 5 minutes, I'll grant you the extra time if you need it, Jerry. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, gentlemen of the council. I'm Jerry Powell. I reside at 1926 Southwest Madison Street. I'm the chairman of the Goose Hollow Foothills League's Planning Committee. And we launched this appeal out of concern for mostly the impact of the approvals by the hearings officer on this small neighborhood. It's a very small area that at the end of a cul-de-sac that's, I think you'd have to call the cul-de-sac itself sort of primitively developed. The street rights of way are fine. The development of the street complies with the city code if you give it a little bit of leeway for a very difficult place to exist, right over the freeway tunnel. That said, in 1980, it looked to the neighborhood, which weighed in on this particular site, to be an area that was probably ripe for redevelopment. And we placed it on the comprehensive plan as appropriate for a R2 sort of row house style of development. At that time, the zone changes that were entertained all over the city did not happen because there was some question as to whether the services actually were available here to support the comprehensive plan designation. Remember, the comprehensive plan is our view of what will someday be. But that vision hasn't been really realized. In this case, the neighborhood has come back. There are families, kids, whatnot on this neighborhood. If we were to look at the neighborhood now, we'd probably not suggest that it's an appropriate place for the row house development. Be that as it may, the hearings officer found probably correctly that the zone change in compliance did comply with Title 33. I bring up our concern about services only because the zone change is from R7, which is a fairly low-density single-family residential zone, to R2, which is a multifamily residential zone. R2 carries with it development standards that are appropriate for row houses, for a fairly low-density multifamily development. To then attach to that further concessions, adjustments to the development standards that allow more intensive development, basically makes this a low-density R1 zone with respect to the development standards, specifically lot coverage, height, and setback from the street. Now, setback from the street in this case is something we're not going to argue with you because it's very, very difficult to build a garage back into a steep hillside. What we will argue is that the side yard setback needs to be probably sent back to the hearings officer. In fact, we would request that you send this back to the hearings officer because the hearings officer did not have the necessary information to make a decision with respect to the side yard setback. There's an easement that goes down that side lot line. That easement carries with it three sewer lines. One of them may actually be under the wall of an existing structure on the site. The easement's actually 2.5 feet on both sides of the lot line. There's a garage wall that's within a 1.75 or 1.9, depending on which plot plan you look at, from that same lot line. It's a private easement. It's probably not something that the city is going to be damaged by an encroachment in. but it certainly affects the at least two of the neighbors very very strongly. The lot coverage that's permitted in the in R2 zone is considerably larger than the lot coverage that was permitted in the R7 zone. It would permit a building that's something in the neighborhood of 25% larger than the R7 zone, the way the lots around it are developed. To then increase that by another 12% permits a building that is 500 square feet in lot coverage larger than the building that would be permitted under the R2 zone. That's a lot of extra lot coverage on a 4,000 square foot lot. Our concern in front of the hearings officer and what we would like to leave you with is that this redevelopment proposal is alleged to be simply to take care of the indiscretions of a former owner. Well, that would be fine with the neighborhood. The neighborhood would love nothing more than to see this development made code compliant and in the spirit of compatibility with the neighborhood. However, the applicant has also taken out a demolition permit for both of the structures that are on the site, leaving us to wonder, what are we really addressing? Are we addressing a new development on a cleared site, or are we addressing the existing development cleaned up and gussied up and made neighborhood friendly? I don't know the answer to that, but our concern when we start looking at the possibility of new development is that with the adjustments that are requested here, a new development could be basically the duplex equivalent of a McMansion on this site. We don't want to see that. All of these sort of theoretical concerns are compounded by the fact that the information that went to the hearings officer did not include things as elemental as even a topographic rendition of what the site looked like. Hearings officer had no way to know some of these things. Our request is that you remand this, that we have a chance for the hearings officer to go back to this thing and do it right this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any person here who supports the appeal of the Neighborhood Association who wishes to testify in this matter?
We have about six people signed up.
Okay. Please call the first three.
We have Wayne Rogers, Janet Klapstein, and Bill Hawkins. They'll be followed by Julie Clifford, Joyce Clifford, and Jerry Powell.
I'm Wayne Rogers.
Hey, could you hang on just a second, sir, while these other folks... Could you sit down?
Yes.
This is a support.
Thanks for being here, folks. Please state your name and you testify, and you each have 3 minutes.
My name is Wayne Rogers. My wife, Maggie, and I live just uphill from the property in question. Shall I go ahead and speak
please,
to it?
Please go ahead, sir.
What I have to say is essentially written out here, and I'll leave this with your secretary. We have viewed this Hilliard House problem as one of a concerned neighbor since we've lived there in our house for 13 years since we inherited it from a Weiss family who built it in 1960 when the sewer easement that you've heard about down the hill beside the Hilliard House was obtained, and that's recorded in the Portland Deed Book. It has a 2.5 feet on either side specified a limit of accessibility, which is not met by the present structures. The concern that we've had, aside from the sewer, is that of a concerned neighbor about the property in general. When we went to the hearing 11-11-06,